We saw last time how Hannah's prayer at the beginning of 1 Samuel set the theme for what follows. These books of 1 and 2 Samuel, they tell the story of the nation's transition from these various independent tribes with occasionally strong leaders called judges to a unified nation under the rule and authority of a king. Now, to tell this story of transition, it focuses on three men. Samuel the prophet, the last of the judges, Saul, the first king of unified Israel, and David, who we'll call the king after God's own heart. Samuel the prophet is vital to this transitional role. He's serving as that kind of final judge of the nation. He leads them to victory over the Philistines. And 1 Samuel 7:15 says that he judged Israel all the days of his life. And then in the next chapter, he sets out a plan to make his sons judges of sort over Israel and sort of mediating his own leadership. But Samuel's sons are evil. They start taking bribes. And so 1 Samuel 8, verses 4 and 5, it says, "Then all the elders of Israel gathered themselves together and came to Samuel unto Ramah and said unto him, Behold, thou art old, and thy sons walk not in thy ways. Now make us a king to judge us like all the nations." Now, we have to ask the question, was it wrong for Israel to ask for a king? And that's really, it's a subject we could debate for quite a while. In one sense, yes, it was wrong. The nation was to be a theocracy led by God himself. In another sense, maybe not, because several hundred years prior to this, Moses wrote in Deuteronomy of a king for the nation and what that king must be like. If you remember in Deuteronomy chapter 17, verses 14 and 15, "When you are come into the land which the Lord your God gives you, and shall possess it, and shall dwell therein, and shall say, I will set me a king over me, like as all the nations that are about me. You shall in any wise set him king over you, whom the Lord your God shall choose. One from among your brethren shall you set king over you. You may not set a stranger over you, which is not your brother." So we could argue that desiring a king was not wrong, but at the same time, the elders of Israel were wrong as their hearts were set on something more than just a king. In both places, in Moses' words in Deuteronomy and in the elders' words in 1 Samuel 8, this phrase shows up. "Give us a king, quote, like all the nations." Wait a minute. I thought Israel was to be a showcase for all the nations, being different, showing them what a covenant relationship with Yahweh looks like. A king like all the other nations would be a king where might makes right. He would be a mighty, strong, formidable military leader. He's the guy everybody could look to with equal parts reverential fear and inspiring confidence. He's a man's man who's going to fight our battles for us, and we'll follow him because we're confident in his power. Now, does that sound like a replacement for somebody else? Who should the nation have reverential fear and confident trust in? If we learned anything from the book of Joshua, who fights Israel's battles? Now, though he doesn't have the title of king, Samuel the prophet has led the nation in righteousness, but that is not what they want. Samuel takes this request of the elders very hard, but he also takes it to God, who immediately puts it into context. By asking for a king like all the nations, the elders of Israel have rejected God himself. 1 Samuel 8, verses 6 and 7. It says, "The thing displeased Samuel when they said, Give us a king to judge us. And Samuel prayed unto the Lord. And the Lord said unto Samuel, Hearken unto the voice of the people and all that they say unto you. For they have not rejected you, they have rejected me, that I should not reign over them. They have rejected me, God says, Give them what they want. When God gives you what you want in this way, that should be frightening to us. The nation could have asked for a king to lead them in righteousness, to be a faithful mediator of God's covenant with Israel, but they want a king like all the nations, and so that's what they get in King Saul. Now, if you've been paying attention, you know Saul is not the king of God's plan for Israel, because we're told right away that Saul is of the tribe of Benjamin, and the promise of kingship and authority was already made to the tribe of Judah back in Genesis. So that should be our first clue that Saul is the people's king, not God's king. But then we get even more when Saul is described as the most goodly, right? The most handsome man in Israel. And that he literally stood head and shoulders above everybody else. Right? Here's that man's man that the nation wants, a king to trust going into battle. And it's apparently successful, at least initially. To God's credit, he doesn't just abandon the nation at this point. God works in and through Saul. There are victories at first. But those victories, as they are increasingly credited to Saul more than to Yahweh, a decline begins. 1 Samuel 16, all the way through 2 Samuel 5, shows this kind of gradual decline in Saul's kingship. So this royal experiment, it looks doomed to failure. But in the background of Saul's decline, we see Yahweh working in another way. Back in the time of Judges, the story of Ruth ended with a genealogy where Ruth and Boaz had a son, Obed, and Obed has a son named Jesse, and Jesse has a son named David. During King Saul's reign, the prophet Samuel is sent to the home of Jesse. 1 Samuel 16 tells this story. Jesse is a man from the tribe of Judah, and a light bulb should be going off in our minds right there with that. And God tells Samuel, you're going to anoint one of Jesse's sons as the next king. The problem is, when he gets to Jesse's house, the man lines up these sons, and the prophet Samuel has no idea which one God has in mind. The oldest, Eliab, Samuel thinks, oh, this is the one, but he wasn't. One by one, Jesse's sons are reviewed and rejected by God. The problem was, Samuel was thinking the same way the elders of Israel were thinking. 1 Samuel 16, verse 7, God tells him that. The Lord said unto Samuel, look not on his countenance or on the height of his stature, because I have refused him. For the Lord sees not as man sees. For man looks on the outward appearance, but the Lord looks on the heart. There is one more son of Jesse, but he's not there in line with his brothers. The youngest, David, he's out in the fields tending the sheep. He is very small compared to his brothers. He is a puny little freckled runt. Now, let me say, if David was standing in front of me, I would not dare have the courage to call him a puny little freckled runt. But that is what he is. God doesn't look at that. God looks at the heart, and he tells Samuel, anoint that one. I'll take the runt and make him king. And what's God's king going to be like? Well, if you're thinking he wouldn't be much of a warrior, you're wrong. This little guy will fell giants. Saul may have killed thousands, but David, it says, kills his tens of thousands. The reason why, though, is because God fights Israel's battles. He is an instrument in the hands of God. Not just an instrument of destruction, though, because David is even going to be an instrument of music in the hands of God. Just as surely as a harp is an instrument in the hands of David, this king after God's own heart, he's not just a king to lead the people to military victory. He's going to be a mediator of the covenant as God intended. He'll write songs. The nation's heart will sing praises to God. That's the leader God's been planning. Now, is he perfect? No, far from it. He's human. And the Bible dutifully records his frailty and his failures as much as it does David's faithfulness. Because ultimately, David's story is not about David. It's become very popular nowadays to point out, for example, in the story of David and Goliath, you're not David. Well, the reality is even David's story is not ultimately about David. It is about a better son of David, a king for Israel, a lion of Judah's tribe. Now, we're going to stop there for now because I want to hold devotion on God's promise to David next time in 2 Samuel 7. It's one of those two places in the Old Testament that I think you must understand if you're really going to get a grasp on God's big story of redemption. I've said that before when we talked about God's promise to Abraham. Now we'll get the other one, God's promise to David, next time.